This podcast was recorded remotely and contains adult themes and language. Hello and welcome to TBDNA Shogun, episode 7, A Stick of Time, and episode 8, The Abyss of Life. My name is Adam Hemming, and someone who's got a stick of time to spend with me is Neil Chapek.
I want to say something Japanese right now, but I didn't prepare that. Amazing end to series one.
Well, it's not finished yet. There's two more episodes to go, Neil.
I'm really glad to hear that, although it has changed my viewpoint on this. I honestly thought episode 8 was the last one, possibly because I've been watching a lot of Ripley, and that finished the end of episode 8. So I think I probably guessed that that was the case with Shogun. Okay, well, maybe it does or doesn't put in the possibility for series 2 because it hasn't finished yet. And yeah, that's how I felt at the end of series 1, was that, okay, this is an interesting ending, but they're deliberately setting up for a second series. And I'm actually really glad to discover that that's not the case.
Yeah, a lot of shows at the moment, I think 8 episodes is kind of a standard number, isn't it, for a lot of shows. But obviously, this is an epic book, so they're using those extra 2 episodes. We ought to say that our other co-host, Damien, has fallen into the abyss of life and can't be with us this evening due to other commitments.
I hate that abyss.
Yeah. It's a nightmare. I've very much been in that abyss over the last couple of days. So my memory of episode 7 and my time to go back over my notes has been limited. But it kicks off with this battlefield beheading and a flashback. We're looking at the first war that Toranaga has won 46 years ago. And he's known as the Boy Warlord.
To be honest, a note, I've not made a huge amount of notes for episode 7 because, like you, that was, for me, months ago. Obviously, it's the week, but it feels like months ago. But watching episode 8, I made a huge note about Hiroyuki Sananda, who plays Toranaga. He's just outstanding. All the performers are obviously very, very good, and the story is told really well. But I did a bit of exploration into what he's done, and he's been in many Hollywood films that I've seen, but I've never necessarily recognised him or noted him. But particularly in this episode, he's just an outstanding actor that had never I'd recognised before, and I want to recognise him right now that he is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I do remember him from Westworld. Yeah, he's done so much stuff. And Toranaga as a character, I think, is so, it gives so little away. You know, he's such a stoic character and doesn't really betray his emotions. So to play that and to give you those sort of nuanced little moments that he does is incredible, I think. Yeah, you're right. He's a brilliant actor.
He is stunning. And obviously, he's a major character within the storyline, the narrative. But you're absolutely right about his nuances. And he gives so little away whilst yet giving so much away at the same time.
Well, I think part of what the plot of episode 8 certainly is so interesting is because none of his followers can read him particularly well. So in episode 7, it kind of after the flashback where we see him, he's seconded by this guy that he's defeated. And that basically means that if they're committing seppuku and killing themselves, but they have someone who basically chops their head off to make sure they die quicker. But after that flashback, we're then back into the main story, and they're seeking the assistance of Toranaga's brother, Saiki. And this is kind of going to be what will turn the tide of the war. In fact, there's a conversation where I think early on Yabushige asks what happens if he says no, and someone says the war is lost before our swords are wet. But Saiki is a total opposite to his brother, Toranaga. He's very much a lad. He wants to meet the barbarian. He wants to go and get drunk. He's been, you know, Kiku has paid a lot of money to entertain him. So he's a very, very different character. And then, of course, as the story goes on, we find out that he's accepted, this is jumping ahead, obviously, but he's accepted the 5th seat in the council. So he's been made a regent for betraying his brother. And then episode 7 very much is about Toranaga, what's he going to do? What's his response going to be? And I think he gets one day to make his response. And then at the end of that episode, he surrenders. And then, of course, episode eight very much is about, has he really surrendered? Do we believe he surrendered? All of that stuff, I think. He's so superb in all of that. You know, there's some really lovely conversations that he has with his number two, Hiramatsu. But you kind of feel like you almost expected his brother to betray him, maybe.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that was set up. What I also really noticed in episodes 7 and 8, but then in hindsight, looking back to the whole thing, I've written down the mistranslation. I would say the careful translation when Mirko is translating between the British guy and any of the Japanese that she's translating for. It's really carefully done, but you can see the politics at play in how she translates, and that plays a big part the further you get in the story of this.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because his Japanese is improving. It's improved vastly to the point where, you know, I think it's episode 8, he bumps into Father Martin, the young priest, and Father Martin says something and Blackthorn is like, well, actually, I understood all of that you just said because Japanese is so good. So you kind of wonder whether he actually needs Mariko there to translate for him anymore at all. But yeah.
I think he needs Mariko for the politics.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it's her politics, not his. Like, he's not in control of how she translates. And I'm not sure if he fully understands what she's saying. But she's being very diplomatic and playing her own game, which I definitely think will come into play.
He needs her for the conduct, almost, you know what I mean? The etiquette and how to behave around all of these different people. You know, she reminds him to bow at one point. So there's a lot of that, and kind of him pushing for his ship and her sort of holding him back and advising him really on how to behave, I think is her more useful role at this point.
For him, but I think she's also playing her own game.
Yeah, I mean, again, I can't remember what how much of it comes out in these two episodes, but she's talked about wanting to die. And at one point, her husband, Buntaro, he invites her to tea. This is definitely episode 8. He invites her to tea. And there's a kind of moment where it feels like there's going to be a reconciliation between the two of them. There's this kind of very, very measured tea ceremony of him pouring out the tea. And then he says, because at this point, Toranaga surrendered. They all think they're going to die. They're going to go to Osaka and die anyway. And it's at this point that he says, well, let's just die together. Let's kill ourselves. I'll grant you your wish to kill yourself, your wish for death. I'll grant it now. And she's basically like, I'd rather live 1,000 years than die with you.
Yeah, yeah. I read that down as well. His actual words was, let us go to death tonight. But yes, she absolutely responds with, I would sooner live 1,000 years than die with you. I mean, it's clearly a marriage of, well, whether it's convenience, it's certainly not enjoyable for her.
Well, and I think she also says something like, you know, the reason I want to die is to get away from you. So, like, it's pretty brutal in that respect from her point of view. But also, it's such a lame offer because he thinks he's going to die anyway when they're taken to Osaka.
Yeah.
It's only now that he thinks he's going to die that he's trying to make amends with her. And let's not forget, he's beaten her in the past. So he's not a great guy.
No. And let's also remember that suicide is quite a noble thing within that, I guess, custom or community. Yeah, it's seen as something very noble. I'm not sure we necessarily see in the same way, but we have to recognize that within that, you know, kind of lifestyle and community, that it is seen as a noble thing. But the way it's presented does feel like it's the last resort, which I don't think is how Japanese culture sees it.
I wanted to talk a bit about the stick of time, because this comes from Kiku's fee. Kiku's the courtesan. Her fee for flirting with Saiki has been negotiated by Mariko, but it basically means that Toranaga has to spend one stick of time with Jin, who is the madam of the Willow's World, I think it is.
Willow Widows?
The Willow World, I think it's the Willow World. The tea house, the very upmarket tea house brothel that she's the madam of. Again, jumping about a little bit, but essentially what she wants, and when he finally grants her that stick of time, because he's like, we don't know how much time we've got left. What she's asking for is a plot of land where they can build their tea houses in Edo, in his city. And initially he's like, you know, there's no way I'm going to do that. But then he writes it into his will that she will get that plot of land, crucially into his will, which I think is really interesting. He tells her no, but then he writes it in his will. And then in episode 8, when Father Martin comes along, he basically says, I'll honour my promise and you can build a church in Edo. And then we get this lovely moment where they're both on the beach and it's clear that the tea house slash brothel is going to be built right next door to the church. Which I thought was a lovely touch.
Another note I made and hadn't made based on that, but I think it is very fitting. Loyalty doesn't have an end.
Is that when, because the sort of Blackthorn's storyline in these two episodes, he's quite keen to get his ship back. And then once Torunaga's said, I'm going to surrender, he kind of stands up and says, has a go at all of Torunaga's followers. Mm. And says, you know, you're sitting there in your silence. I can find the quote, I'm sure. And that definitely has consequences for the end of episode 7, which we'll get to. But when they get to Edo in episode 8, he's like, he basically tells Mariko to give him his diaries back, send him on his way. He's fulfilled his service to me. He can have his ship and all of this sort of stuff. And he can have his men back. And he then goes to Yabashigi and tried to sort of offer his services to him. But he's all part of Torunaga's grand plan. But I think it's Mariko saying it to him because he's like, you know, my duty to Torunaga is done. He's let me go. He's released me despite my offer. And is he saying to Mariko, you can come with me? I can't remember. We'll have to come back to it. But I think that's basically the Anjin story in this sort of arc, is that incites something at the end of episode 7 and then he's trying to work out what he's going... He still wants to be fighting his war against the Catholic Church, right? He's almost being a bit like Yabashigi and trying to work out who he can be most useful to, and not necessarily being loyal as Mariko is to Torunaga.
I mean, after watching episode 8, I... Partly because I was so impressed by the performance of Torunaga, I did a little bit of research on who that character is based on. It is a fictional account, but it's based on Tokugawa Ieyasu. I'm sure I butchered that pronunciation, but he was the founder and first shogun of the Tokugawa shogunate of Japan, which ruled from 1603 until 1868. That might potentially provide spoilers for this story, but a really powerful person. And certainly in episodes 7 and 8, I've just been really impressed by initially the performance, but then I looked into the actual character that fictionally he's representing. It doesn't mean that the story is going to follow fact, but it suggests that he's going to be victorious. And I'm absolutely stunned. In the same way with Ripley that I mentioned recently, it's like, is he going to get away with it? Is he not? If he does, how does he? And that's kind of how I'm feeling about this character is... You know, he's saying that he's going to commit suicide and he's going to give up. But I kind of don't believe that. But I have no idea as to how, if he doesn't do that, how that happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely by the end of episode 8, we're convinced that he's not going to surrender. He just needs them all to believe that he's going to surrender. And we'll kind of come on to that. I want to talk about Nagakado for a little bit, Torunaga's son, because... You know, we get this scene where they're all having a drink and he's kind of really eager for battle. And he's talking about, you know, his first kill. And he says they say that the first kill is better than the first pillow. And Yabushige says, that depends on the woman. It was brilliant. But I think the comparison between him and Toranaga at the start of the episode in that flashback is that Toranaga killed first and was then going to be able to pillow, whereas that's obviously the opposite for Nagakado. So there's a lot of teasing about laying with women, and then a lot of stories that come out about the boy warlord, about him chopping this head off in one sweep of his sword. They talk about Kiku. They say, beauty's a fleeting pleasure, like trying to grasp a river or fuck a sunset, which I thought was a really brilliant, really brilliant phrase. But yeah, then it comes out, essentially, after Saiki tells another story about Toranaga shitting himself. He's basically received another offer. His army blocks off all of the roads, and Toranaga is ordered to come back to Osaka with the new regent, Saiki. And Nagakado also gets charged with the Josen One's murder and ordered to commit seppuku. And he's kind of handed a scroll, and Toranaga tells him not to accept it. I just thought this was all absolutely brilliant stuff. That moment of him turning around and saying, you know what, I'm now a regent and you're all fucked. But yeah, level of tension was just ratcheted up superbly well in that moment.
Absolutely. And for any character to not necessarily witness, although that is eventually what will happen, but to accept the reality of their child's demanded suicide is absolutely massive.
But Toranaga basically asks for it. He said he'll consider the request and give his reply by sunset. And at that point, my note was, he's got something up his flowing sleeve and not just his other arm. It was, let's talk about Nagakado's end. Because once Toranaga does surrender, he takes it upon himself to attack. So he tries to attack Saiki. Before this, there's a kind of a scene where he shares a hot spring with Omi, and Saiki turns up. So he's kind of taunting him a little bit. He says, death is just a lonely path in the woods. But yeah, when Nagakado attacks, it's just a brilliant, brilliant scene, because he ends up winning and having Saiki at his mercy. And as he's about to deliver the killing blow, slips, falls in the water, and cracks his head open on a rock. It's such a brilliant ending for this young, brash kid. Yeah, it's gutting, but also incredible. I think it's Saiki says, you know, where is the beauty in this?
Yeah.
Yeah, what did you think of that moment?
It was heartbreaking, really, because the character, and I guess a large part of that is the performance by the actor, was so, I guess, so lovable, regardless of the politics at play, really well performed. And certainly for me, it was heartbreaking that he died so dishonorably, because that's such a major part of that kind of culture. But I think he was saved by, I can't remember his last line of episode 8, but certainly one of the last lines, when Tara got said, basically, well done, my son, you bought me some time. And that kind of made sense of the death. It's hard to explain, but if you follow Tamagara, it's everything plays a part. If you follow that everything works out in the end, then that kind of made sense of the son's death, at least as part of the story.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, right, do you think that this is all part of the big plan? Do you think that he knows that by surrendering, someone's going to end up trying to do something, you know, because he gets like 49 days to mourn his son's death. So he gets a massive amount of time before he's impeached. That, you know, they were talking about impeaching him in episode 1 or 2, and we're now
in episode
8, and it still hasn't happened. He's managed every twist and turn to avoid this thing taking place. I mean, very much like the whole of episode 8, they talk about whether or not they've been, Achiba, the heir's mother, who's working with Ishido, doesn't believe that he's really surrendering. And, you know, and his own troops and followers don't believe that he's really surrendering. And in order for them to really, truly believe it, A, he needs the Anjin to do something, and B, he needs Hiramatsu to kill himself, which he does at the end of episode 8. Mm. In that incredible scene where he's asking all of his followers to essentially sign their own death warrant by saying that they will follow him to Osaka. He wants them all to put it in writing that that's what they're going to do. Fascinatingly, Yabushige and Omi are the ones who do sign, which I think is brilliant. Well, come on to Yabushige because he's still one of my favorite characters. But it's Hiramatsu, when the other lords sort of stand up and say, look, we don't think this is the right thing to do, it's Hiramatsu who says, change your mind, Yoshi. Otherwise, you know, I am your longest, oldest friend. Change your mind. Otherwise, I will commit seppuku here and now. And he has to let him do it. He can't because he's gone on that sort of path. He has to let him kill himself. But what that means is they're going to believe now that this is real, that he's really surrendering, when actually he's not at all. He's, you know, he's planning something else completely. But he's had to sacrifice his son and his best and oldest friend in order for that to be the case. And I don't know whether that was his plan all along or whether he's just delaying and seeing how the cards fall.
I think he is delaying and seeing how the cards fall because I don't see how he had any influence in his son's death. I don't think that was necessarily part of any kind of calculation or plan. It's just what happened. What do you think?
I mean, I think if he had been successful in killing Saiki, then he would have been punished sort of down the line at some point. You know, he's killed a regent of the council, effectively. So Nagakado, already in trouble for killing Jozen, would have been in trouble for that. So it would have led to an open war. So yeah, and that's clearly not really what Yoshi wants. He talks about what's good for the realm rather than what's good for his clan. So I think he is trying to avoid all-out war because he knows how many people are going to die if that's the case. So yeah, I think he's playing such a fascinating game, and I'm not 100% convinced that it's all working out exactly the way that he'd like it to, but he's being able to take advantage of all of these tragedies despite what it costs him in terms of the people around him. For him, it's all about the realm and all about Japan. And people are going to have to be sacrificed and are going to die. But he doesn't want it to be, you know, masses of people. And that's why he's avoiding going to war.
I want to come back to what you say about seeing how the cards fall. I think he's a very good poker player. He is literally seeing what cards are being dealt and how to play them best.
Yeah. There was some really lovely dialogue in the scene between Toranaga and Jin. She says, Willow World is pouring your life out in service of great men. Your youth, energy, wit, charm is given away. Flower wilts and you are given away. And then the fate is like a sword, useful only to those who can wield it. Really, really brilliant stuff of this. And then, you know, her stick of time is finished. Her time is up. All of that really lovely stuff. And there's also a great scene in episode 7 of the Anjin and Yabushige. I think he just has some of the best stuff, Yabushige. There's a whole scene of him facing off with somebody over the hot springs. And then he says to the Anjin, every death I escape, there's another waiting. And speaking to you is like pissing in the wind. They have this sort of little sword fight, and he's almost training him how to use his sword. It feels like Yabushige wants to goad him into learning how to use the sword. And Blackthorn says, this appears to be occurring. I was like, you're such a dweeb. But I loved it all. I thought all of that stuff was really, really great. And I think Yabu is just hilarious. And, you know, he takes great pleasure in turning the Anjin down in episode 8. But eventually, obviously, they become colleagues at the end of episode 8.
It's also really powerful when Blackthorn throws his sword down. It's like, that's not my weapon. And in many ways, therefore, turns his back on the whole culture.
Yeah. I've just found the quote of when Blackthorn confronts Toranaga's men after he's surrendered. He says, behold the great warlord, the brilliant master of trickery, who tricked his own loyal vassals into a noiseless smothering. You're all dead. Crimson fucking horseshit. But yeah, episode 7 was by far my favourite episode so far. So much happening in it. Really, really brilliant dialogue. Great twists going on. And that ending was absolutely phenomenal.
To be honest, you've made me the happiest I've been in the last hour or so, in that there's still two more episodes left.
But let's quickly cover the rest of episode eight then. Again, I think a lot of this is covering this idea of, is Torunaga really surrendering or is he not? And the sort of back and forth between all of that. He seems to have developed this cough again, whether that's a real thing or not, I don't know. But there's a lovely moment at the beginning where we learn that Yabushigi's got a book that ranks death, and falling over and hitting your head on a rock ranks just above boiling alive, but below being eaten by dogs. And it reminded me in those early episodes of his fascination with the moment of death. Like, he's really fascinated by the man that they boil in the pot, because he thinks there's going to be some sort of epiphany when at this moment of death, and it's never kind of there. But yeah, we've talked a lot about this stuff already. There's a lovely funeral or wake scene for Nagakado, where they're all kind of talking about him. Buntaro says he was full of long stories that went nowhere. We learn that he broke his arm and didn't tell anyone, and that he was truly courageous. And then Hiramatsu says he was reckless and it was a waste of a life. And then Omi, I really like Omi as a character. He's growing on me much, much more. He says he would have enjoyed us honouring him. He's not, because our Lord has surrendered. His life was given to Torunaga. Yeah, I'm really curious to see what Omi's role is going to be in these final few episodes.
I really enjoyed episode eight. I have to say, it's really difficult to make notes when so much of it is in subtitles. We obviously had very similar with Ripley that we've been following, but it's really tough to, unless you've got loads of time to make notes. And mostly because I was just glued to the screen. You know, I had to read the subtitles. I wanted to follow the story. And as I said earlier on, I think Torunaga is playing such an amazing game. It even makes me think of the Game of Thrones. There's so many politics going on. I think Blackthorn, he would obviously play a big part because he's the protagonist in the last couple of episodes. But at the moment, he's not being given much, I guess, screen time. I mean, I've not read the book, so I don't know what was written, even if that's how things are going to play out. But I'm absolutely enthralled by what's going on.
Yeah, more and more as it goes on, I feel like Blackthorn is kind of our avatar into this world, and he's kind of there to have the customs and everything explained to him as they're being explained to us. And it feels more and more like it is Torunaga and to a lesser extent, Mariko's story that we're watching unfold. Talking about those politics, there's a moment where Father Martin has a meeting with Torunaga and basically tells him what he already knows. The priests were supposed to get two of the regents, the two Catholic regents, on side, and they failed to do all of that. So he basically asks Mariko to translate what Father Martin says now, because the church is no longer our ally and cannot be trusted to speak in our tongue. But his suggestion is basically that Torunaga should form an alliance with Achiba, and the heir will turn against Ishido. But Achiba hates Torunaga, as we talked about last time round. And Mariko says fear is her enemy. She doesn't say it's impossible, but she says that if Achiba was afraid enough, she would switch sides, I think, even despite the fact that she hates you so much. But yeah, Torunaga is emphatic that the victory will come at too high a cost, so he chooses a peaceful defeat. And, you know, I will have no further bloodshed. I want the signed pledge of my vassals that they will march and surrender. And he is convincing. Like, I genuinely, although I had my, you know, little niggle at going, he's definitely got some sort of game, I could see it potentially that he needed to convince everybody else, because it was so out of character for him to surrender. He needed to do drastic things.
He's playing a game. And I'm sure that will add to the enjoyment of watching the last few episodes.
But Hiramatsu, the guy, his best and oldest mate, who does end up killing himself, he tells others that Torunaga's going to fight, otherwise he wouldn't have sent the priest back with a message. And I wonder whether Hiramatsu knew that Torunaga needed him to commit suicide to convince everybody else that he was surrendering, you know what I mean? It's such a complex sort of back and forth there, and what was really in their minds, I don't think we can ever ever know.
It's a huge sacrifice, though, to kill yourself and making assumptions as to what the gameplay is.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I'm doubting it in any way. I think there's lots of gameplay with Toranaga. That's huge.
Yeah, I just found the quote that you were talking about earlier, but Blackthorn gets led to his men, his sailors, who we've not seen since the first episode, I think. And they've basically been holed up and have been bothering the courtesans and drinking and not doing much else. And they've got no interest in working for Blackthorn anymore. But then he goes to Yabu and offers his services. Yabu calls him a shit-faced but brave, which I thought was nice, or the other way around. She says, once loyalty begins, it does not have an end. And he says, loyalty is senseless when the order is suicide. A lot of discussion about loyalty throughout all of this. Could loyalty ever be harmful? I think Omi is questioning it as well. He doesn't know what he's fighting for anymore. Kiku says to him, if you look and see nothing, you must simply look harder. Which again, such great dialogue in this show.
Yeah,
as you say, it takes me about 3 hours to watch an episode because I want to write it out. The other big thing that happens in this is that Lady Dioin, I think that's her name, has a stroke. And this is the Taiko's wife. She was a big ally of Ochiba. And she tells Ochiba to stop the games, release the hostages, and that Ishido, who's proposed to her, I think at the beginning of this episode, that he comes from nothing and is nothing. So she's kind of pushing Ochiba to distance herself from Ishido as well. So there's kind of another little play here that senses that Ochiba's loyalties might shift. And then we get the big meeting with Yoshi and his vassals. And Buntaro, who is the son of Hiramatsu, is asked to second him. It was just so intense, like all of that stuff, you know, ultimately. And he is the one, you know, when he seconds him, he chops his head off in one stroke. And we learned through a story that Hiramatsu and Toranaga are talking about how he had, you know, when he was a boy warlord, he had 8 or 9 attempts to chop that guy's head off. And again, it's a really nice parallels and contrasts between some of these stories and scenes. Yeah, and then there's a sort of poetry off between Mariko and Toranaga, which was a bit weird. I'm not gonna repeat those lines. Maybe I'll sign off the podcast with that. But he basically says that the Anjin and Yabu are now going to work together, calling them goshawks, short-winged and predictable, comparing things to birds again. He says, Hiramatsu knew his duty well. Asaka needs to believe it's real. Can you do your part? And Mariko says she's ready. And presumably that is to persuade Ochiba. She was friends with Ochiba in their youth. So presumably that's what Mariko's role is somehow in all of this. But I don't know that for sure. And Mariko turns up with a note from Toranaga. And then we see Yoshi going to his son's funeral ashes and thanking him for giving him the time, as you said earlier on. And he says, I will not waste it. It's really well set up for those last couple of episodes, I think.
I think the politics is what really makes this. And I do think that the shows that we've become addicted to, whether it be Succession or Game of Thrones or even Line of Duty, to be honest, it's the personal politics that are at play that makes them so compelling. I will absolutely watch every episode of Shogun, and I'm just compelled to find out what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's fantastic stuff. Well, let's wrap it up there then. We've got two more episodes to go, so our final Shogun episode will come out in a couple of weeks' time. We've just released our watch list episode covering, was it Renegade Nell we did last? No, something else. Ripley, last one we did. And we're going to be talking about Scoop and Fallout in our next watch list episode. Plus, we've got our specials for Blue Lights coming up as well. If you want to let us know what you're watching or what you think about Shogun, you can contact us on the social media at TVDNAPod, or you can email TVDNAPod@gmail.com. Shall I finish on this poem then?
I've got an end line. Do the poem, I'll do the end line, and then you can decide the best way to edit.
The sound of rain on the leaves can be heard. Still more fragile is the dew of tears on my sleeve, even in springtime. Waiting, the pine tree never withers in winter. If I could use words like scattering flowers and falling leaves, what bonfire my poems would make.
I don't know what I'm fighting for anymore.
So sad. Brilliant. Thanks for this, Neil. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Bye.